The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, the U.S. abandoned Israel before the U.N. We'll hear from Brett Baer.
I thought it was a big moment.
It is an alarming shift, as we've long been Israel's most reliable ally.
The world essentially wants Hamas to win.
Dan Senor looks at the willingness of the administration and American media to repeat the lies of Hamas.
We are in a new world where that information is not qualified and discredited, and that is a catastrophe.
We'll also look at the reduction of former President Trump's bond in the New York City case. Andrew McCarthy.
He would have had to post a bond of closer to $550 million.
And the IPO of Trump's Truth Social. Trish Regan.
He is a lot richer, and there's a kind of sweet justice in all of this.
We've got all this and more. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning, live 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at hughhewitt.com. And please follow me on X at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. Town Hall Review is part of the Salem Podcast Network. We're going to start at the UN, where on Monday the Security Council passed a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. It's actually no surprise that such a resolution would be put forward at the Security Council. It is a very big surprise that the United States allowed it to pass. First, the United States abstained. Then it did not even think about using its veto power. I turn to Brett Baer of Fox News. The United States abstained, Brett. They abstained. Either you can vote for something or you can vote against something, but to stand back and say, I don't know, when you're the superpower that leads the world, what did you make of that on the Security Council resolution yesterday?
Yeah, I thought it was a big, big moment. I think the hinge point probably during this time was Senator Schumer's speech on the floor that, you know, castigated Bibi Netanyahu and kind of set the table. But that is clearly a policy decision, despite everything that Kirby said from the podium, that this is not a change in policy. Israel sees it as a big change in policy. And if you read the resolution itself, it does not mention the word Hamas once. And there is not direct linkage between the long-term ceasefire and the release of hostages, or that one has to come before the other. And, you know, to abstain essentially is a nod of go ahead, you know, pass it. And I think that that's a policy change.
You know, in the last month of the Obama administration, they did this. They passed a hostile to Israel UN Security Council resolution that we did not veto. This is, I think we're going to see realignment on this issue, Brett Baer, because I don't think they're doing enough to garner in the Arab American votes that support the Palestinians. I don't think there are many people who support Hamas, but there might be. And they're certainly driving away supporters of Israel. Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, I think around the edges they do. I think they're trying to make the case that this is Bibi Netanyahu specific, but I think that they're reading the room wrong, and that you're going to have some in the other party in Israel that have a real problem with abstention on that vote. And you're clearly going to have problems with some American Jews who feel like that was the wrong move.
Now, you know, I look at someone like Sherrod Brown, who's running in Ohio. Ohio has a huge Jewish community in Shaker Heights and in and around Cleveland. I think of Philadelphia. They have a huge Jewish community. Detroit, my roommate from college lived in Detroit, Jewish kid, big Jewish community in Detroit and Michigan. These are swing state Jews. I just don't think that they understand what they're doing.
I agree with you. I think that politically it is they're trying to walk this tightrope. And as of late, they've tipped towards the progressives and the Arab American voters who have expressed concern about Israel policy, you know, and I don't know. I haven't fully figured it out politically, but I know that they're trying to pass it off that this is not a policy change, which Israel clearly thinks it is.
We're witnessing a dramatic shift, something that Hamas has taken note of. The Iranian-backed terror group will, no doubt, stall for time, making it harder on Israel. The mullahs in Iran have also taken note. It's a dangerous ship. Here is Dennis Prager.
At the UN, unanimous with America abstaining, calling on Israel to have a ceasefire, which means lose the war, end the war. There was no demand that the ceasefire be conjoined with even releasing the hostages. There was a demand in another resolution, but it was not contingent. In other words, it wasn't ceasefire if Hamas releases the hostages. I can't even go there. What the hostages must be suffering. If they have been in tunnels the entire time, which is quite possible, I don't know how they're sane. Minimal air, minimal food. We don't know how much they're mistreated, especially the women. The world essentially wants Hamas to win. I want you to reflect on that. You just wonder, like, why are the European countries, which still have a slight residue of Judeo-Christian values, why are they rooting for Hamas? And if you deny that they're rooting for Hamas, you're lying to yourself. I don't know if they're in their hearts they're rooting for Hamas. I don't care about their heart. I care about their deed. Israel stop fighting means Hamas, please win. That's what it means. End of issue.
There is an enormous gap in how Americans are learning about this story. One big part of that is because our legacy outlets are so one-sided in how they report it. Dan Senor is the host of the excellent podcast, Call Me Back. He was my guest on my program. Does everyone understand the communications gap? There's a vacuum which Dan Senor and the Commentary Podcast are filling in the United States. And here and there you'll find other people. But it's so one-sided. Do they understand that now?
Yeah, they are. I was struck, Hugh, in my conversations with Israeli government and military leaders on this trip, how they realize it's gotten particularly bad. I mean, the misunderstanding about the humanitarian assistance, that Israel's getting shellacked in the press here for this humanitarian crisis in Gaza, as though it's Israel's fault, is extraordinary. And I think they recognize they have a real problem.
Dan, when you got Ambassador Dermer to come sit down with you, you were in the Knesset in a conference room next door to him. When the Hamas Ministry of Health, the Gaza Ministry of Health, when they put out one of their numbers, where does that come from physically? Is there a Gaza Ministry of Health? Is there a building that says Gaza Ministry of Health on it, or do we just get sent something on the internet?
It is. So there is a office, Ministry of Health, but that's not where the information actually comes from. Hamas has a press arm, a propaganda arm, and that is the arm that deals with reporters covering the war that are in Gaza or in touch with Hamas officials in Gaza. And so the press arm of Hamas gathers, quote unquote, the information from the Gaza Ministry of Health, and they disseminate it to reporters over here. And they say, we've gathered this information from the Ministry of Health. So it's not as though the Ministry of Health is actually, in most cases, I don't think, communicating directly with reporters.
But Dan, that's so absurd. It's the most absurd part of this absurd war.
Hugh. It gets even more absurd. The way, when you probe how they actually collect this data, because the data is all over the place. So it's interesting. My next episode of Call Me Back, I'm interviewing a University of Pennsylvania Wharton data science professor who literally has calculated all the data that's come out of the Ministry of Health and can show just from a data analytical standpoint it and says it's total nonsense. It actually doesn't add up. The data contradicts itself. But the Ministry of Health or the Hamas propaganda arm distributes the information won't distinguish between civilians and combatants. They claim that they have doctors at morgues and hospitals who pencil down numbers as bodies come in, and they report it to the Gaza Ministry of Health, who then gives it to the press arm. But of course, it's so silly. You remember in the middle of October when there was this quote-unquote attack against the Al-Hilla hospital, which was blamed on Israel immediately by the U.S. press. And then in moments, it was revealed that it was actually Palestinian Islamic Jihad that launched an errant missile that landed in the hospital parking lot that killed all these Palestinians. But the Gaza Ministry of Health instantly, in a matter of minutes, knew the number of Palestinians that were killed and gave a very precise number of, I think it was the 500 Palestinians killed in that moment. How did the Gaza Ministry of Health, if there's this terrible attack within the world?
To me, it's the great failure of American media, is that it repeats anything from the Ministry of Health. It's like repeating Tokyo Rose or Goebbels. And people don't seem to get that in the media. Does the American media not understand this, or are they purposefully and willfully throwing in with the left?
I'll tell you, Hugh, I used to think they did get it, and that was partly because of the Biden administration. The Biden administration had rightly discredited the Gaza Ministry of Health as being unreliable data. Early in the war, in the weeks after the war, the Biden administration, to their credit, made it clear to the press. I spoke to many people in the U.S. press who were making editorial decisions, who said, look, once the Biden administration said we're not respecting this information, we can't respect this information, they started caveating it. And then Biden suddenly started citing the data and didn't qualify it. And that completely undermined, I think, the good work the administration had done for the first few months of the war in discrediting that information. So I'm afraid now we are in a new world where that information is not qualified and discredited. And that is a catastrophe.
I don't know how a war in the North doesn't seem to be the natural progression projection of events that have occurred thus far. What is your assessment of the likelihood of that war happening in the North?
I tragically think it is inevitable. You have 200,000 internally displaced Israelis inside Israel. About half of them, a little over half of them, are from the South, from where the October 7th attack occurred. And then the balance are from the North, where Hezbollah poses a threat on northern Israel. And Israelis are not going to move back to either area unless they can do so and feel secure. And right now, those in the north do not feel secure because of the threat of Hezbollah and Hezbollah's capacity to launch an October 7th attack against Israel. And they certainly have the intent. And they're more dangerous, if you can believe that. Hezbollah is about 10 times the manpower and arms of Hamas. And they're better trained. And so most Israeli officials believe that a war in the north is inevitable against Hezbollah. And in fact, many friends of mine who were reservists who were called up to fight against Hamas in Gaza now have a little bit of a reprieve because a lot of the reservists have been called back, reintegrated into daily civilian life. And they have all been basically told, be ready. You may be called up, you know, soon. It could be months. It could be longer. But there's going to be a war in the north.
Coming up, Andrew McCarthy on Donald Trump and the New York court case.
He would have had to post a bond of closer to $550 million, so it was good that the court came in and intervened the way it did.
When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
This is Dennis Prager, and now a truly exciting new benefit. My monthly online video get-together for Pragertopia Plus members only. For an hour each month, get an exclusive chance to ask me anything. I'll be answering your questions. I've never done this. Submit your questions for me at Pragertopia.com. This is our chance to connect like never before. Go to Pragertopia.com or click the banner at DennisPrager.com.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The latest development in the court battles of Donald Trump occurred in New York this past week, where Justice Arthur Engoron found Trump guilty of manipulating his net worth and set a bond of between $450 and $460 million, depending on where the interest is right now. An appeals court took a look at that and reduced it to $175 million. Andrew McCarthy explains for us. McCarthy was a guest of Joe Piscopo on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
You looked at Donald Trump, though. He got the bond reduction to $175 million, and that is making sense. Does that lead you, in that Tish James case, does that lead you to believe that this may just very well go away as far as that Engoron case? That just could go away in the appeals court, or will it end up in the Supreme Court, Andy McCarthy?
Well, I've always thought, Joe, that he'll get a significant reduction on appeal. I don't know that it's going to go away. I still think $175 million is high.
Yeah.
Trump has a lot of real estate in New York. It's not going anyplace. If he didn't have to post anything, it's not like Tish James wouldn't have had assets to enforce against if she ultimately, you know, prevails after the appeal. But I think there's a good chance that the outrageous judgment here in a case with no victims will be significantly reduced on appeal. But in the meantime, it's accruing at $112,000 a day. So like every 9 days, it's another $1 million gets added to it. And the bond that Trump would have had to post, people keep saying, you know, it was a reduction of a $454 million bond. He would have had to post a bond of closer to $550 million because of the accruing interest. So it was good that the court came in and intervened the way it did.
Yes, it was good that the court intervened. But this case and this judgment, all these cases against Trump, are expensive. How can he do it? Trish Regan looked at the IPO of True Social.
DJT. DJT, that is the ticker of the moment. It just debuted on Wall Street, on the New York Stock Exchange. And ladies and gentlemen, wow. I mean, this stock price, it's up 45% today, $72.36. At last check. But he's just been climbing and climbing and climbing and climbing. And just to back up a little bit, remember, he's got this thing called Truth Social. Donald Trump, former president of the United States, now running again to be the 47th president of the United States. He got kicked off of Twitter. I love this. You know, this is the beauty of America. This is American capitalism at work. You get kicked off of one platform, so guess what? You go and you start your own. And that's what he did. He started Truth Social. And True Social merged with something called DWAC, Digital World Acquisition Corporation, in what's known as a SPAC, Special Purpose Acquisition Corporation. These things, they pool a whole bunch of capital together, and then they go out and they look for something to buy. And so DWAC said, you know what, we're going to go buy Trump's True Social. And that's exactly what they did. And then they had to go through all the rigmarole and through all these hurdles because, you know, the SEC, et cetera, is like, what are you doing buying Trump's company? And anytime you're involved with Trump nowadays, it invites a whole level of scrutiny that you might not otherwise have. And so the feds were all over this thing. Nobody wanted to make any money at all. But ultimately, the SEC approved the deal. So then the deal was voted on. Shareholders approved the deal, and today the deal's done. The company is trading no longer as DWAC, but as DJT. How do you like that for a ticker symbol? And it's flying. They can't keep shares of this in stock. You know, this is actually amazing because the company doesn't have much in the way of earnings. I mean, I've seen estimates between 3 and 6 million and only has some 37 employees, and yet it's worth billions of dollars, making Donald Trump that much richer. Like, he went to bed being worth maybe $3.5-4 billion. And he is now today going to go to bed tonight worth over $6.5 billion. He's now getting named to Bloomberg's list of 500 richest people in the world. I mean, he was rich before this. He's really rich right now. This is going to be interesting to watch, ladies and gentlemen. And if nothing else, is it not just kind of a really good how do we say this? I'll just say, is it not a giant F you to Letitia James and New York City and that judge who so desperately wanted to really stick it to him, so much so that they came up with this unheard of, absolutely positively unheard of bond to the tune of $500 million? Well, now he's got like $6 billion. I mean, wow. I mean, that's, he's got 80 million shares of this thing. I mean, Letitia, he may just have the money. Now, a lot of people said, well, wait a second, he can't sell this for 6 months. Turns out that in this particular vehicle, if you need to sell some of your shares, if you've created a certain kind of value for shareholders, there is an opportunity apparently to do so, so long as you have approval of the board of directors, which consists of, well, a lot of his friends and his son. So he's got his son on the board. He's got Linda McMahon. Remember, she was the small business administrator married to Vince McMahon. You've got Robert Lighthizer. You've got Cash Patel. You guys know Cash. You got quite a team there that I think they're going to say, you know what, you need the $175 million. We're going to give you the $175 million to keep Letitia and company happy. So watch this stock very carefully. Obviously, if he pulls some capital out, shares would go down. But hey, ladies and gentlemen, he is now worth a lot of money. He is a lot richer. And I think there's something kind of cool, kind of neat. And there's a kind of, how can I possibly say, like a sweet justice in all of this? I've been talking about that a lot because I'm just amazed at the timing. I said the other day, he's got to have some guardian angel somewhere because this is like poetry. I mean, really, when you have a guy who's so down on his luck as he's being faced with $500 million fine from Letitia and the judge that just hates him, and then he comes back with this. My goodness, right? My goodness. Wow, wow, wow. Yeah, we'll see if it holds. But I think, you know what's going on? People are saying, I feel for him. I want to help him. I like him. And this is their way of expressing that. That's what you are. I mean, people say, oh, it's a meme stock because the earnings aren't there to generate this excitement. But again, it's beauty in the eye of the beholder, right? And if you're somebody who is a Trump fan and wants to back him, maybe you're seeing this as a vehicle to do that. And, you know, if you lose money, you're not going to be happy. So I exercise caution with all of these things. I'm just trying to explain the psychology of what's really going on. And I think this is sort of classic meme in that people are excited. They're excited about him. They want him to be president. It could serve as a little bit of a proxy, if you would, for his presidential campaign, which is hurting a little bit in cash. But, you know, they get so many legal bills to pay. So maybe this will help. I mean, of course, it doesn't all come down to cash. Let's remember that. Donald Trump had less cash, a lot less cash than Hillary Clinton, and he still beat her. I mean, it was a really darn close election last time around. And Biden had a lot more cash. So I actually don't think it's always about money. It's often about something else. And so if this stock is indicative of what is to come for the future, well, that's really positive news.
Coming up.
The issue is when the iPhone got the App Store and notifications. So now millions of companies can install software on the phone in your kid's pocket.
Phone-based childhood. When the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. In just 10 minutes, I can zip through 10 stories that help me start my day and help shape where I go with the Mike Gallagher Show. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Kids and phones. We know that the two seem to go hand in hand today. Whether it's an iPhone or an Android device, all of us have recognized these devices have become ubiquitous. But they are changing us, and they are changing childhood radically. Jonathan Haidt is the author of the just-released and very important book, The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. I love the fact that throughout you make your thesis statement clear, page 139. I'm saying, you write, that the great rewiring of childhood, in which the phone-based childhood replaced the play-based childhood, is the major cause of the international epidemic of adolescent mental illness. This is not an opinion, John, right? This is the science.
There are always debates within the science. This is my reading of the scientific literature, which I've been debating with other researchers since about 2019. I think that my side, which includes Gene Twenge, the author of iGen, I think the trends, the new research has supported us. So, you know, in terms of the scientific literature, I believe the preponderance of the evidence supports that claim, exactly that claim. What I do in the book is I review not just the research on depression and anxiety. That's where the academic debate has been. I say, even if we put aside depression and anxiety, these things are clearly fragmenting our kids' attention. They can't pay attention. There's a lot of research on that. They are addicting. Between 2 and 10% are basically have a behavioral addiction. They're depriving our kids of sleep. They're pushing out books. They're pushing out hobbies. So even if I was wrong about the depression and anxiety claims, there's so much else that is happening to our kids because their lives moved away from play, normal human childhood, and into this weird virtual world created for adults by corporations whose goal is to grab their eyeballs and never let go. And these corporations have a congressional grant of freedom from liability. They can't be sued for what they do to our kids. It's completely insane what
now,
is happening.
I'll stop there for a moment. I do believe we are on the cusp of liability. I don't know that liability has been established yet for any of the producers of this, but the book of yours collects enough evidence for me that I'd be very worried if I was one of the owners of some of these social media companies about the consequences. Has it succeeded as a cause of action anywhere yet?
So as far as I know, no, but here's the key thing to keep in mind. The Congress granted tech companies immunity from being sued for being liable for what other users post. And that makes sense. AOL back in the 90s, you know, you couldn't have people suing AOL because, you know, Joe Smith put up something nasty about Tom Moore. I mean, the original purpose of the law was reasonable, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. But the courts and common practice seem to have interpreted that so widely as to say the companies can't be sued for anything that they do to your kids, even when the plaintiffs can show that they put in features specifically designed to pull in minors, underage users, to hook them, to addict them. The design choices that they made for their platforms, those have somehow fallen under the umbrella of Section 230. So as far as I know, none of the suits have succeeded yet, but there's a huge wave of, not exactly a class action lawsuit, but of grouped lawsuits moving through the courts. So we're going to find out in the next year or two.
And I think what we're going to find out is that the social media companies like the cigarette companies have got a nasty situation on their hand that will result in billions of liability. But let's go back to 2007 and the first iPhone. Did they have any idea when they began, John, in your honest opinion, what they were unleashing on the world? Or were they just having fun?
No. Well, let's distinguish between the hardware, which is the iPhone, and the software, which is Meta primarily, because they were the first and the biggest, both with Facebook and then with Instagram. So in terms of the phone, no, I don't think so. The iPhone in 2007 was an amazing, amazing invention. I got one in 2008. You should think of it as a digital Swiss Army knife. You know, like you pull it out when you needed something. Like if I needed a map, I'd pull out my phone. If I needed a flashlight, I'd pull out my phone. The phone was not commanding me to do things. It wasn't interrupting my day. There were no notifications. There was no app store. So, you know, the Apple iPhone was an incredible world-changing product that most of us, most adults love. The issue is when the iPhone got the app store and notifications. So now millions of companies can install software on the phone in your kid's pocket. And by default, they have the right to interrupt your kid, whatever he's doing, and try to get his attention, say, hey, do you want to see what someone just said about you? Click here. Now, you can turn off the notifications, but most kids don't. So it really is not the iPhone in 2007, 2008 that caused the problem. It's really the period from 2010 to 2015, which I've called the great rewiring of childhood, where at the beginning, most kids have a flip phone. They don't have an iPhone in 2010. But by 2015, they have an iPhone, they have a high-speed data plan, high-speed internet, they have an unlimited data plan, they have Instagram, and now you've got kids. Many kids are spending 10 hours a day or more on their phones. In fact, the average today is between 7 and 10 hours a day just on their phones.
Coming up.
They're not taking risks. They're not learning how to measure risks. They're not doing things that would help them turn into men.
More with Jonathan Haidt when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
John Solomon provides exclusive reporting and newsmaker interviews on John Solomon Reports on the Salem Podcast Network.
We broke this story because we got the documents early. They put out this new information, and it affirms our reporting that this Democrat donor gave about $5 million or more in assistance to Hunter Biden, basically paid off his bills.
Subscribe to John Solomon Reports today on Apple, Spotify, Google, Rumble, or at SalemPodcastNetwork.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The aversion to risk, that is one of the most revealing windows into how digital devices have changed childhood today. It is revealing and it's measurable. Let's pick up with more of my conversation with Jonathan Haidt, author of The Anxious Generation. And what's interesting, John, like teenagers everywhere and preteens for all time, they know how to avoid the detection of what they are doing that their parents have forbidden them to do. Right. They know how to get out of the house at night. They know how to get alcohol. They know how to drive. They do everything. But you point out, I mean, Gen Z, quote, are not doing as much bad stuff as teenagers used to do. They drink less alcohol, have fewer car accidents, get fewer speeding tickets, have far fewer physical fights or unplanned pregnancies. Well, I guess that's good until you realize they're not going out. They're staying home, sucked That's into right. this weird world of online games and online chatter.
That's right. So even your characterization before, that they know how to sneak out at night, they know how to get alcohol underage, that's not true anymore because they're not doing that. Basically, you come home from school, you sit on your bed, you're on your device. That's what a lot of kids are doing. We found amazing data for the book about injuries, broken arms, broken bones. Teenage boys used to have the most. Teenage boys, they're doing reckless things. They're
lived it, been there, done that, been to the ER. Yep.
Yep, That's right. That's right. But that no longer happens very much because teenage boys now are slightly less likely to get injured than 50-year-old men. Teenage boys today are slightly less likely to have a broken bone, a broken arm than teenage girls were 15 years ago because they're not doing anything that could possibly injure them. They're not having adventures. They're not taking risks. They're not learning how to measure risks. They're not doing things that would help them turn into men.
Yeah, John, when I read that, I did not realize the adversity to risk. And I talked to my daughter yesterday, and she got a 19-month-old who just almost broke himself in two yesterday. I said, that's good. We want bruises. We don't want scars. And that's a quote from your book, which I'm not just going to tell.
How did she respond to that?
She said, good, because we're going to get plenty of them with this guy. This guy's just a tyro. But okay, would you explain that to people? Because I think it's one of those lines, we want bruises, not scars, and we want a lot of bruises.
Well, I didn't quite say we want a lot of bruises. I gave a talk. So summer camps are some of the most amazing things that you can send your kid to today because they're one of the few places where your kids can detox from their phone. And summer camps have a lot of physical activities. And I gave a talk to the Camp Directors Association a few months ago. And I said, what is the optimum number of times per summer that a kid comes to the infirmary with an injury more serious than a scrape? Is it zero? Would you like to run your camps that nobody ever gets hurt? Is it 1 to 3 or is it like 50 to 100? And I don't know what the correct answer is, but I was really glad to see nobody picked zero. They all recognize, no, if not a single person is getting hurt, then kids aren't taking risks. You're not letting them swing on a rope into the lake. You're not letting them run. So that's what I meant by that, that we don't, there's a great Canadian play researcher. She says, we need to keep kids as safe as necessary, not as safe as possible. And since the 1990s, we've been keeping our kids as safe as possible, which means we're blocking their development. They don't have adventures. They don't take risks. They don't learn how to become self-supervising. And then we send them off to college where professors like me have to deal with students who don't know how to manage their own affairs or how to face exclusion or someone ignoring them.
I often talk on this show, Jonathan, about my 4-year-old granddaughter, who I call Genghis Kate, because she is a looting, ravaging, coming from the steppe of Asia kind of person. And when I go to the playground with her, I lose her. And I've learned not to lose that. It is the exact replication of your advice. The cure for parental anxiety or grandparent anxiety is exposure to it, meaning go a few times, let them out of your sight, and then you won't lose any sleep over it. It's wonderfully practical advice in this book.
Yes, because a big part of the problem is the parental anxiety. So there are two halves to the story in the book. I can summarize it by saying the problem is that we have overprotected our children in the real world while underprotecting them online. And we have to reverse both mistakes. Now, overprotecting our kids in the real world, yeah, it includes not letting them walk three blocks to a playground. It includes not letting them climb up to the top of the jungle gym. Oh, wait, there aren't any jungle gyms anymore. Well, there are sort of climbing structures.
I love the picture of the old gym.
I have the same experience. yes, that's right. There's a picture in the book, you know, of kids climbing up like 25 feet in the air. I mean, that, you know, things used to be too dangerous. I'm very glad that there was a consumer safety revolution. We needed that. That's a good thing. But yeah, it's, you know, the first time my wife and I let our son walk to school. We live in New York City. It's, you know, it's very safe in terms of crime, but there's a lot of confusing traffic and bicycles go in the wrong direction. And the first time we let him walk to school in fourth grade, we were really anxious and we tracked him. You know, I'd given him my iPhone. I, you know, nowadays I would give him a watch or a flip phone. And the first day we were so anxious watching him cross 7th Avenue, which is a complicated intersection, but he did it. Of course, look, you and me, we were all crossing streets when we were 7.
I want to recommend to the people in the country who have book clubs that you get this because it's actually very practical. In fact, John, the last 25 pages are very specific and I want to get to the age of the phone. And I, for a long time, said if you let kids drive a car first, they'll be able to negotiate the virtual world later. And so I'm so glad that you agree with what I've been preaching to my kid: no phones until 16. Would you explain why that is? No iPhones until 16.
So the proposal I offer in the book is no social media until 16, no smartphone before high school. And the reason is that once a smartphone enters a child's life, it's going to take it over. There's really no way to stop that. There's so much interesting stuff happening. A smartphone is an experience blocker. It's give them a lot of experience through the phone. They'll get dating through the phone. They'll get sex through the phone. They'll get entertainment through the phone. They'll get news through the phone. But they're not going to spend as much time talking with other people. Now, in an ideal world, I think we'd wait till 18 for that. But I understand that's not practical. Some parents may want to do that. I'm not saying don't give them a phone. You can give them a flip phone. A lot of parents tell me the Apple Watch works great because they can communicate, they can text, but the kid can't reach the internet. The key idea here is that puberty is a very, very special time in which a child's brain is rewiring. It's literally changing its neural configuration, beginning in the back of the brain, moving to the front, to change a child's brain into an adult brain. And the most important part of this rewiring, easily disrupted by experience, is the prefrontal cortex, the area just behind the front of the forehead. That's the seat of executive control, a kid's ability to focus, to set goals. It's really important that kids develop executive function. And the social media platforms, we know from leaks about Facebook, they know all about this, and they know what kids' vulnerabilities are, and they exploited them. So what I'm arguing is, let's at least protect early puberty. Let's at least get all of this out of middle school and elementary school. Kids need to play, they need to do face-to-face interaction, they need to develop basic skills. And there's even evidence that the greatest period of harm is 11 to 13 for girls, but 14, 15 for boys who enter puberty a bit later. So I'm saying let's protect puberty as much as we can for as long as we can. And I'm suggesting a norm, because if parents are just told, wait as long as you can, well, when is that? When is the pressure overwhelming? What I'm trying to do is say, hey, how about we all just adopt a norm?
Coming up.
If young people change their habits, they can change their attention. If they change their attention, they change their lives.
In the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Stay with us.
Charlie Kirk here. It is critical we keep AM radio in all cars and all trucks. More than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio for news, weather, and opinions. AM is also the backbone of the emergency alert system, keeping you advised of threatening weather conditions and amber alerts. Text AM to number 52886. Tell Congress that we need AM radio in our cars. Again, text AM to the number 52886. Standard message and data rates may apply.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. This issue of digital addiction that we've been looking at today is much easier to avoid in the first place than it is to fix or cure once you see it in your family. But I recognize life is not always that simple. Let's catch just a few more minutes of my conversation with Jonathan Haidt, talking about his very important new book, The anxious generation.
What do we do if the child or the teenager or the young adult is already addicted, is already withdrawn, is already, I'm never going to give you a phone or I'll hurt myself, I'll cut myself, or anything like that? What does a parent do?
So, of course, it's easiest to delay when they're young. But look, most of us, all of us who have teens, the teens are already on phones and mostly on social media. What do you do? Well, don't despair, because there's a lot that you can do. Now, what they're afraid of is being isolated, being separated. And so everything gets easier if you can talk to the parents of their friends. If you have a small group that is doing this together, then it becomes much easier because they're terrified of being the only one left out. But if there are other kids, then it's much easier. But even if you don't have cooperation from them, from other parents, what I'm finding in my class at NYU, I'm a professor at New York University's Stern School of Business. I teach a course called Flourishing, about 35 undergraduates, mostly sophomores, 19 years old. Most of them are addicted to their phones. They check their notifications the very first thing when they open their eyes in the morning. It's the very last thing when they close their eyes at night. They get 300, 400 notifications a day.
God.
And what I do with them is I say, okay, look, do you want to achieve something in your life? And these are business students. They say, yes, we want to do something. Do you think you can do anything if you have zero attention to devote to your projects? No. Do you want to regain control of your attention? Yes, they all do. So I say, okay, let's take out your phone. You have given permission to hundreds of companies to interrupt your work whenever they want to. That's crazy. So I say, turn off all notifications except for five. You get to keep five. So once they shut off their notifications, it's like you're pulling cobwebs out from in front of their eyes. Like, they actually tell me things like, wow, I was able to do my homework last night in an hour. I just sat down and I did it. Because normally everything is multitasking. Everything is continuous partial attention with very low quality work. It's not set in stone when they're 12, 13. It's habits that develop, and the brain is still malleable until the mid-20s. So if young people change their habits, they can change their attention. If they change their attention, they change their lives. So in Britain, their problems are the same as ours, actually a little worse. Their kids are on even longer than ours are. Now, in Britain, they have a functioning legislature. They have a parliament, and their parliament has made some laws like phone-free schools. Like, their parliament has mandated that schools must lock up phones during the day. So the rebellion began in Britain last month, and I'm very confident that we are at a tipping point right now in America. We're here. Parents are fed up all over the country. They've had enough. They're tired of hearing, like, oh, it's your responsibility, parents. We cannot, as parents, we cannot keep our kids out of bars and strip clubs if the bars and strip clubs won't check IDs. We can't keep them from doing things they're not supposed to do if the companies won't participate at all.
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. You can get my complete conversation with Jonathan Haidt at theuniverse.com. If you enjoyed the program and the podcast, do me a favor, share it with a friend. Let me point out, you can get this podcast, Town Hall Review, Trish Regan, my own podcast at the Salem Podcast Network. If you liked our program, do us a favor and mention it to a friend. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producers David Bouchon, Alex Perez, Harley Eide, Adam Ramsey, and of course, Dwayne Patterson. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.